Hi, Horror Honeys! We have an amazing deal for you from Adam and Eve, America's favorite adult store. Use our code HORROR for 50% off almost any item, plus free shipping. Yes, you heard that right, 50% off almost any item, plus free shipping. Head to adamandeve.com to find something special for yourself or someone else. That's code HORROR, H-O-R-R-O-R, at checkout. For 50% off plus free shipping. Order now and get ready to f.
Right into crime. Hello, everyone.
Welcome back.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of I'm Horrified.
I'm Horrified. We assume you're coming back. If you're just dropping in on this episode,
welcome.
Welcome in.
I'm Sam, and that's Allie.
I'm Allie and that's Sam. We don't say that often.
I try to mix it in every, like, four. I'm trying to be like, here we are again.
That's our marketing scheme. You gotta listen to more to find out what our first names are.
Big
information
mystery.
That should be very clear.
Huge mystery.
But, yeah, you'll get it every now and again.
I'm also very inconsistent. Sometimes in the episode descriptions, I'll put, like, this week Sam takes Allie on a journey of blank. And sometimes I'm like, this week, holy shit, here we go. And, like, I don't give it any whose episode it is or what's going on.
I do genuinely think it would be enjoyable to have a larger listener base at one point. I'm terrified of more people listening to our podcast and thus more ears listening to the inconsistencies I've done over all of these years.
It's just lore. It's just deep lore.
That's exactly right.
Someday we'll have like a wiki.
It's all part of it.
Of people being like, on this date, Allie said this. But on this date, Allie said this.
That's exactly right.
And we can only hope that will exist.
I hope so. It will. It does. Everybody could sign off right now and we keep doing it. So, frankly...
Oh, the podcast, yes. I thought you meant the wiki. I was like,
the Wikipedia.
I have not created a wiki just for us, personally.
If anyone's got some spare time on their hands.
Who has a million spare hours?
And
they don't want to solve poverty or
whatever. As long as it's not mean.
As long as it's not mean.
Please don't say anything mean to me.
Amen.
I wish I said that to more people. Don't say anything mean to me.
I watch, and I think you do too, a YouTuber whose name is Curtis Connor. And he has some merch that says, be nice to me, it's the law.
Yes.
And I'm not a big enough fan of his to actually buy merch, but that merch is so relatable to me that I'm like, perhaps I should buy this because you should be nice to me and it is the law.
I had a really healing moment with a friend of mine who I work for. I'll shout her out, Shannon Potter, my sweet friend, Shannon Sexton Potter. I was working at her business and we were having like a meeting to discuss something and I had made some kind of mistake. Mm-hmm. And I was like starting to like become like a laptop making that whirring sound, you know, like I was just freaking out and like starting to breathe heavily. And she just like looked at me and was like, nobody gets in trouble here. We're adults. And I was just
wow.
Like, yeah. Literally, like, I have been in so many jobs where I'm, like, spoken to like a toddler, like a particularly dumb toddler. And she's just like, why would we as two adults ever yell or be unkind to each other? Like, that's so stupid. Why would anyone do that? And that was a very healing moment for me. Thank you, Shannon.
That's a beautiful moment.
It's a beautiful moment. It was very healing as someone who has had some really terrible bosses and terrible work experiences.
Yes. And that is healing. But segue time. Sometimes there are adults that you want to yell at.
That was healing and this will be.
This is healing in a different way.
What's the antonym of healing? Sickening?
Yeah, hurting. Injurious?
Yeah, injuring. Well, let's have it. Let's Yay. Have it, Sam.
Oh, I'm excited.
Give us your worst.
You're going to like this one, Allie.
I'm feeling. Excited about it.
Sometimes when you do a podcast like this, you guys, you end up Googling phrases like worst heists ever. Just to kind of see.
Just to, you know, as a barometer.
What comes up. And when you do that, you find a story of four white boys that makes you so mad. So this is that story, the story of the Transylvania University book heist of 2004.
Now, when you said that, I, because you said the title.
Yes.
I fully assumed that this was in either, like, the place, like, Transylvania, when Transylvania was a place, at, like, a sort of gothic era college. And it was, like, an ancient manuscript or something. But you're telling me that this is in Kentucky in 2004.
It absolutely is Kentucky in 2004.
Okay, so that's a different energy, but I am still in.
But it's still 20 years ago, so it's maybe history.
I'm still in. I'm still here. Okay, ready for it.
Our story begins with childhood friends Spencer Reinhard and Warren Lipka, who had grown up close to each other in Lexington, Kentucky. They first met when they were on a soccer team together at the age of 8, and they had stayed best friends ever since. Warren was the more athletic and outgoing one. Spencer was a little bit more overachieving academically and very artistic. But they were besties all through high school. Even though they actually did not go to the same high school, they still stayed very close. In 2003, they both began their freshman year at college. Warren had received an athletic scholarship to the University of Kentucky, and Spencer was going to Transylvania University. He was going to their arts program for graphic design. The schools were only a mile away from each other, which is very close. But as is the way with college, the boys fell out of contact a little bit as they acclimated to their new environments.
Right.
Very common. However, they're both experiencing some ennui when it comes to their freshman year. And now I'm going to talk about, there's a great story that was kind of like the first comprehensive story that came out on this topic called Majoring in Crime by John Falk for Vanity Fair. Mm. And he was kind of the first people to get this, three of these four boys to sit down for interviews with him. So this is from that story. For Spencer, it all started with a series of mild disappointments. I was expecting to play soccer quite a bit, but the coach was a completely different person once I got on the team, he tells me. And I pledged a frat, but I really didn't get into it all too much. In all my art classes, I was the only guy, in with a bunch of girls who didn't have any idea what they wanted to do. All these girls I could draw better than when I was in sixth grade.
Okay, not loving the tone.
And I'm also going to say, like, to me, this is a kind of classic college experience of, like, you're used to being a big fish in a small pond. And then you go to college and it's like, oh, actually a ton of people are better than you at soccer. And
oh my God. And at our college, we went to Emerson College in Boston. Every person was that girl in Annie getting off the bus, like the musical Annie, when the lady gets off the bus and she's like, NYC.
Everybody.
Like, I'm here and I'm ready to dazzle the world.
Yes.
Every girl from every high school who was that went to Emerson.
Including us.
Including us.
Absolutely including us.
I think we had a good dose of deep insecurity that kept us humble.
Yeah, I think so too. We were not the worst offenders by any means. But yeah, so to me it's like this very classic college, like, oh, I'm actually not the coolest and the fastest and the best. Mixed with like a flavor of, like you said, misogyny. Like, he might not have realized his major was a predominantly female major. And I wonder if just realizing that made him go like, actually, it's stupid.
I have to learn next to these girls.
Yeah. So basically, he was not a shining golden boy immediately. And it bummed him out. Spencer did try to do like the typical freshman activities. Specifically, at one point, he takes a tour through the Transylvania University Library, a very normal freshman activity, getting a tour of your campus. The tour takes him through the special collections at Transylvania University, which actually holds a lot of very rare and expensive books. Specifically, it holds a copy of Birds of America by John James Audubon. And you should hear Audubon and be like, that's a very famous name. And it's a 4-volume set of life-sized engravings from Audubon, who's this, like, pioneering artist. The set was one of fewer than 200 ever produced, a really, really limited run. It was original to the 1830s. And the tour guide tells this story that another of those original 200 had recently sold for $12 million. Hold that in your mind.
I'm sure that won't come back up.
And let's check in with Warren. Also from this Vanity Fair article. Across town at the University of Kentucky, in a towering cinder block dorm, Warren's world was spinning apart at a much faster clip. His malaise was likely exacerbated by his parents' impending divorce amid his mother's allegations that his father, Big Warren, the celebrated coach of the university women's soccer team, had gambled the family into bankruptcy, Big Warren declined to comment on the gambling accusations at this time. When not at practice, Warren spent his time smoking pot, watching Comedy Central, and reading German philosophy.
Okay. Wow.
And he tells Vanity Fair, "It was very punishing that first couple of months in college. Not what I expected, not what I wanted it to be. I wanted to say living that kind of life, the country clubs, sitting in a classroom and listening to two girls argue about turning down a BMW because she wanted a new Range Rover. Like, what? These people's perspectives, because they have money, they're tweaked. Now, I have a lot of sympathy for a child of divorce."
Fair enough.
But again, Warren is really throwing himself a pity party here because he didn't immediately click into being the golden boy of his college life. He does what I believe is the classic move of a cisgendered man of blowing up his whole life when one thing's not really working. And he
a classic move.
And he quits the soccer team in October of his freshman year, losing his scholarship in the process. He is still technically enrolled, but he's basically out. And he's looking for something to do, so he gets into crime.
Oh, okay.
Right into crime. He starts selling fake IDs on campus, which is obviously a super lucrative idea on a college campus. I also think maybe this gave Warren some of the it boy status he was missing, because who doesn't love the kid who can get you a fake?
Amen.
In this endeavor, Warren partners with a friend of his from high school who was also attending the University of Kentucky, Eric Borsick, who had the Photoshop knowledge needed to get the job done. By November, they had a flourishing small business, and Eric told a Vanity Fair reporter that they had expanded into other small-time crimes, but is, like, weirdly shady about what they are. A note on the timeline here, because when I realized this, it cracked me up. You start your freshman year, like, what, August? End of August?
Yeah, I think we started, like, the last day of August and the first day of September.
By October, Warren has quit soccer and stopped going to class, and in November, he is a thriving criminal.
I feel like that makes complete sense, based on my understanding of him as a person.
All I'm saying is, when my parents got divorced, I just became very emotionally unavailable. I did not do one crime.
Not even one, Sam?
Not even one crime.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. I simply didn't speak to anyone about my feelings for about 3 years, which is much better.
Emotionally criminal.
Emotionally, perhaps, criminal.
A therapist might say.
Fun fact is that I was, as you guys may know, I was dating my now husband at the time because we dated in high school. And he found out that my parents were actively going through a divorce because one time he was dropping me off from a date and I was like, oh, you have to drop me off at my dad's house. And he was like, your dad's house? As in... not
that's a crazy move on your part
with your mom.
In fairness to Adam, like that's wild.
Oh, it was me. No. I'm saying a funny story about me is that I did that to this nice man.
Yeah, he's just like, okay, then that's information that I have now.
And then later, his mom was like, "Why didn't you tell me Sammy's parents were getting divorced?" And Adam was like, "I did not know. I genuinely did not know."
Ugh, poor thing.
All I'm saying, divorce can throw you for a loop. It doesn't force you into crime. So, alas, the criminal enterprise of Eric and Warren does not last too long. $2,000 goes missing from Eric's drawer, and the two have a falling out, which leads them to no longer speak. Warren is now a lone criminal wolf who cannot use Photoshop. Then Warren remembers, wait a minute, my old soccer buddy Spencer is going to graphic design school like a mile away. Perhaps he can join me in my criminal enterprise. And Spencer immediately says yes.
Perfect.
So now the two start getting high together and selling fake IDs. You know, bro stuff. In one of these moments, as they're getting high in the car, Spencer reminisces about his tour at the Transylvania University Special Collection. And here's that conversation as remembered by Warren to Vanity Fair. Spencer said, I just took a tour in that library and there's shit sitting there that you wouldn't believe. They said that this set, Birds of America, sold for $12 million. And I said, $12 million just sitting there? They got security around that? Nonchalantly, very nonchalantly. I mean, just kind of shooting it between us. So I kind of go, that would be pretty crazy, wouldn't it? And he said, yeah, it would be kind of crazy. And I then said, you know, why don't you look into it more and we'll go from there? Just like... very unofficial.
Literally like, oh my God, can you imagine if we kissed?
Yes.
And then, like, maybe we should kiss. But not unless you're not interested in kissing. And in that case, it was a joke.
Can you imagine if we stole $12 million worth of rare books?
And then after this conversation, they had that exact conversation.
Yes. What if we kiss?
What if while we were heisting, we talk about our relationship?
What if we kiss in the Transylvania University Special Collection?
Yes! Exactly.
So, in my opinion, high thoughts become sober action weirdly quickly. Like, I see a world where you are high in a car and you talk to your friend about stealing a book. They start, like, putting things into motion so soon. Spencer is a TU student, so he's allowed in the library all the time, and he starts scoping it out. He realizes that during the day, there is basically no security to the special collections. It's just a sign-in book and an older librarian named Betty Jean Gooch, known affectionately to students and staff as BJ. Meanwhile, Warren starts to think, what would we even do with $12 million worth of rare books? He goes back to some contacts he acquired through the fake ID world, and they point him to a guy in New York named Barry. Warren and Spencer drive to New York with a bag of weed and a dream, and they meet with Barry, who is immediately turned off by the fact they are clearly 19-year-old idiots.
Barry's like, I don't know how you got my business card, but lose it. Yeah.
Again, here's Warren to Vanity Fair. He was visibly unnerved, Warren remembers. It was hard for us. We weren't like hardened criminals, so we kind of had to really put up a front. Warren deepens his voice. How you doing? That kind of stuff. After an awkward back and forth, Warren finally handed the man $500. In exchange, Barry slipped him an email address with instructions to sign off any communication with the name Terry. So they make a fake Yahoo email address. It's 2004. They send the email to Barry's rare book contacts, and they are told that they should come to Amsterdam to make contact in person with a black market rare book seller.
Okay.
At this point, and not for the first time, Spencer's like, okay, I mean, this is the end of the line, right? Like, there's no way we can go to Amsterdam and meet with a black market rare bookseller, right? And Warren's like, bet.
Warren!
And he goes back to his fake ID contacts, and he's like, I need a fake passport.
Oh my God.
And it's so intense. And then by God, he goes to Amsterdam. It's just
a fake passport.
With a fake passport, just him, because it's really expensive to fly and they're idiot college students. He meets the black market book dealers. They are also like, you are a 19-year-old idiot. But Warren convinces them to go through with the meeting. The meeting doesn't go that well, because not only does he not physically have the books at that time, he also doesn't have, like, a photocopy of them, any evidence that he has them. To quote Vanity Fair, he does not have even the slightest ability to intelligently discuss the books.
Incredible.
But Warren does get some good info from this trip. Namely, that to sell the books on the black market, they will need to be appraised by a legitimate auction house first. So, like, the black market dealers want some proof that they're real.
Wouldn't them being from the university, or I guess you can't prove that.
Yeah.
Do they not have, like, a black market auctioneer guy who can, like, authenticate it on the side?
I don't know, but that's not what they tell Warren. They just say, we're going to need some kind of authentication.
How do we get that?
These books. And so a new step in the plan is now forming in Warren's mind. But to get that plan to work, they're going to need some more men. Let's welcome back Eric, Warren's former partner in fake ID crime. Eric describes the call to Vanity Fair. Warren called me one night and he's like, we need to get together. We need to just get over this stuff. Eric tells me, explaining how Warren re-entered his life after the falling out the previous semester. So we ate at Pazzo's Pizza Pub.
Okay.
And we had a few pitchers, feeling each other out. He's probably thinking I blamed him for stealing the money, which I never really did. And one thing led to another, and we were just like, let's put this behind us. And once we get past all that, we start talking about this plan that he and Spencer have.
Oh, it's so beautiful for a moment. And then the crimes come back.
Again, this is Eric. Warren was like, I've talked to these guys. I've met with them. They think we have the books. Now the hard part. We have to steal them. I was nervous. I'm not going to lie. Because this is so much bigger than anything we've done before. But he's in.
You son of a bitch. I'm in.
So crazy to me that everyone that got approached about this plan was like,
yeah, let's fucking do it.
Let's go.
Let's pull the trigger.
The three continue planning. It's now the fall of their sophomore year. And Warren has dropped out to focus on the heist full time.
I mean, it's got to be a lot.
Spencer is still living in the Transylvania University dorms. And Warren and Eric are both renting rooms in a house owned by the father of one of Eric's friends, Chaz Allen. Chaz and Eric both are in a bedroom upstairs. There's like one more upstairs bedroom. And then there is an unfinished basement that Warren rents to save on money.
Jeez.
But from this unfinished basement, the plan unfolds.
God.
And interestingly, as the plan unfolds, they decide we're going to need one more guy because they know the books are going to be pretty heavy. And they're like, we physically just need more manpower to carry them out. And so Chaz Allen is added to the fold of the heist.
I knew. I was like, once you said his name and didn't just say a roommate, I was like, Chaz is involved.
Chaz is in. He and Eric had worked together over the summer. And so they're like, we need one more guy. Chaz, it's you. At first, Chaz kind of makes fun of the other three for this insane idea. And it does seem to me, like, through reading this, that Chaz is perhaps a little bit better off than the rest. Although none of them are living below the poverty line. Like, they're all coming from at least middle class Kentucky.
They seem like the kind of people who would, like, nickel and dime you. Like, they've, you know, like, they're actually, like, in distress financially.
Yeah.
But they get, like...
But they're fine.
Financial, yeah.
Yes. But... Then Chaz hears them out, is like, whoa, $12 million, and so he's in as well.
Fair enough.
Spencer continues to get intel. He's drawing pictures of the special collections room, and he's making appointments with the librarian, BJ, to kind of scout it out, which makes me so sad, because she probably just thought this young man was very interested in these rare books.
Aww.
And she was like, oh, how fun that, you know, little Spencer's coming back.
I love to see the young people getting interested.
He was trying to heist. The other three are doing Ocean's 11 shit. They're like watching the rotations of the librarians. They're climbing onto dorm roofs to like try to scout. They probably feel so cool, but they suck so fucking bad.
This is going to go down in flames, obviously, I can tell.
They're Googling things like auction house appraisal, stun gun, Swiss bank account.
Incredible.
And according to Vanity Fair, they actually do get together to watch Ocean's 11.
Oh my god! Oh my god. That's amazing. That's my favorite part so far.
In October, Warren debuts his big plan. Here it is, as told to Vanity Fair. Phase one begins in the bungalow, which is the house that the three of them live in, when all four get into what Warren has designated the GTAV, or the go-to and away vehicle. Such a stupid, the GTAV, I have no idea. They're all planning to be disguised as old men. Phase one ends when the GTAV is parked in front of the library and the four are in first position at the bottom of the stairs. Phase two is the actual theft, and it begins when Spencer takes position at an upper floor window of the nearby athletic center where he's going to be on lookout. Like we've mentioned, Spencer's an actual student at Transylvania University. So he's at the biggest risk of being recognized during this.
Right.
So the plan is, like, he's kind of just lookout. If someone sees him, they're just like, oh, yeah, Spencer goes here. And it's not weird that he's standing in a hallway, but, like, he can't really steal the books.
Maybe a little of, like, why is he dressed like an old person?
Yeah, maybe a little of that. The plan is for Warren and Chaz to go up to the rare book room on the third floor, where Warren will have made an appointment with the librarian BJ, pretending to be a rare book collector wanting a tour. Upon entering the room, Warren, quote, brings Gooch down hard and fast.
What?
Her name is Betty Jean Gooch, but...
Oh my god. Oh, yeah. Oh god.
I think that's a very funny quote from Warren.
That is a funny quote.
With a stun gun, making her, quote, a non-factor throughout the operation.
What? They stunned an old lady?
Well, this is their plan. It's what they're planning to do.
They planned this?
They're planning to stun Gooch.
This sucks.
Poor Betty Jean Gooch.
It sucks that they did that.
It really does, right? Warren and Chaz are then going to let Eric in, and they'll wrap up the Audubons in bedsheets and put any smaller books into their backpacks. The three will then take the staff-only elevator down to the bottom floor and escape out the west fire exit. Phase two ends when the loot is loaded into the GTAV, the go-to and away vehicle. Phase three is the escape, which involves switching the GTAV for a second vehicle at a secret location, which, according to Warren's plan, is used to transport team and loot to temporary resting place. After the heist, since it's certain that the stolen books will be entered into art theft databases, they have to get the books appraised immediately, like before everybody knows they've been stolen.
Can I just check in quickly? Are you describing the plan, or are you describing what happened?
That was the plan.
Okay, got it, got it.
It has not happened yet. He's just saying, here's the plan. I'm going to cough really quick, and then I'll tell you the rest.
But he does stun the Gooch? Sorry. But he said he did do it.
What's his plan to?
Oh, I thought, so he didn't say, like, okay, all right, got it.
His plan is I'm going to take down Gooch fast and hard. What's the plan?
That's making me laugh.
He's 20 years old. He's a 20-year-old from Kentucky.
She's old. She can die. No, she doesn't die, right?
You'll find out.
No! Does she die?
You're going to find out.
Oh, my God.
Okay. On December 16th, they make their attempt, and it is immediately not working. Problem number one. The original GTAV was going to be Eric's friend's car, but that morning, Eric's friend is like, oh no, sorry, I can't lend you my car today. And obviously, Eric cannot be like, we were going to do a heist today, we really need your car. Luckily, Chaz's mom is selling a Dodge Caravan the next day, meaning it's available this day. Problem solved.
Perfect.
Chaz's mom has the car. Problem two. Warren had ordered a stun gun online, but it has not arrived in time. How is he supposed to make BJ a non-factor if he cannot stun her? So he goes,
you
just
can order a stun gun online?
That's 2004.
Okay, fair.
He goes into town and he purchases a Black Cobra stun pen. And then in a very, like, 20-year-old college boy move, Spencer zaps him and Eric to test its knockdown power. And they're like, fine, this is gonna work. Problem solved. Problem three. When they arrive on campus in the replacement GTAV, there are no parking spaces near the library.
Good.
Chaz has to drive around and basically stay in the car, like, just idle, waiting for them to do this, which now means they only have two people to bring the books down. Problem four. Their old man disguises look so fucking stupid. Spencer had hoped that he was going to have time to practice with the old man makeup to make it look good. And to do that, he had tried to move when he was taking a final. But his professor had been like, no, you can't move the final. You have to take it then. So Spencer didn't have any time to practice.
And even if he did, like,
it just looks very stupid.
Oh my God.
And it ends up attracting way more attention because they look so dumb.
Like, why are everyone's... you dressed up like a silly elderly man?
Yeah. And finally, problem number five. They assume that the rare books room is going to be totally empty, as it often is, but they happen to arrive at a time when there are a ton of people in there. That stun pen's going to be going into overdrive if they have to neutralize everyone. So that day, they pull the plug. Warren calls Betty Jean and asks to move the meeting to the next day, which she's happy to do. They decide we're going to scrap the old man outfits. They're not working, but Warren bleaches his hair that night to be like, maybe I look a little different. And the new plan is that just him and Eric will go into the library, Chaz will stay in the car, and also, because they're borrowing this car, Chaz needs to return it to his mom by 12:30.
My mom needs the car at 12:30.
Yes. Attempt number two begins. December 17th, 2004. Librarian Betty Jean, BJ Gooch, has an 11 a.m. appointment with Walter Beckman, a man she's never met. Over the phone and by email, Beckman had asked to view many of the books in the special collection, including Charles Darwin's Origin on the Species and the John James Audubon Birds of America. Wearing a heavy coat, gloves, and a wool cap, but no stupid old man disguise, Walter Beckman signs the visitor's log. With a long, thin face and bleached blonde hair and sideburns, he is younger than BJ expected. He's also less cordial and more agitated in person, and like the minute they get into the room, he asks if he can invite a friend along to see the books. She agrees, and within minutes, a short, dark-haired young man, also in a winter coat, cap, and gloves, enters the library. He says his name is John. John is, of course, Eric. And Eric is very surprised when Warren calls him up to the library and BJ is still walking around. he had kind of thought the plan was that she would already be stunned.
She should be neutralized.
She should be neutralized. As he tells Vanity Fair, when I got up there, BJ opens the door for me, and I'm like, holy shit. I quickly came up with some fake name and started walking in, and I'm like, oh shit, this is going to happen at any moment. So while I'm shutting the door, I look back, and Warren took her to the ground. And that's when I came up, I took my zip ties, and I put them around her feet and around her arms.
Oh, that's like real, real crime.
Really scary.
This is real crime, and I'm not, that's not funny.
I know.
It sucks.
So I wanted to make sure at this point I brought in BJ's voice, which, like, she didn't really get interviewed in that initial Vanity Fair article, but she talked to the Associated Press years later, and she said, suddenly, I'm mid-sentence, and Lipka, who's Warren, says to Borsuk, who is Eric, grab her hands, and he's pushing the stun gun into my left arms. I'm trying to process what's happening. I realize they're robbing us, and I'm so shocked by that, and I think I even screamed once, but I realized no one could hear me. I fall to the ground, they lay me on my stomach, they bound my hands and feet. They put Lipka's hat over my eyes and tried to put duct tape on my mouth. I was scared I was not going to be able to breathe, and I was terrified I was going to have a heart attack. I have a family history, and I'd been under so much stress. I just remember thinking, I have to calm myself, I just have to get through this.
Oh,
poor BJ.
That's awful, that sounds awful.
As they are neutralizing BJ, Warren says at one point, quit struggling, BJ, or do you want to feel more pain?
The fuck?
I know. After the heist, though, this stands out to Betty Jean, because it's really only colleagues and students at TU who call her BJ.
Oh.
But in this moment, we're in the heist, and Eric and Warren have underestimated how heavy these Audubon books are.
Good.
There are 7 folios, and they discover that they can only handle, like, 2 or 3 at a time. So they fill their backpacks with the smaller books, and they're carrying, like, 2 of the folios between them in a sheet, attempting to head down the back stairs on their first trip to the GTAF, and their hope is to make multiple trips to get the rest of the books.
For real?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to improve upon their crime, but I would just be like, get what you can and bounce.
Well, there you go. Unfortunately, their escape is a comedy of errors. As Eric retold it, Warren and Eric rode the elevator to the basement, but they couldn't find the fire exit.
Good.
So they go back in the elevator, accidentally stopping on the main floor, where they're spotted by another librarian. This librarian doesn't know what we're carrying, but she's like, where did these kids come from? Eric says. So we go back down to the bottom floor just to get away from her. I guess when we did that, she went upstairs to check on BJ.
Oh.
Realizing the only way out is through the main floor, they take the elevator up once again and carry the books into the back stairwell that led out another exit. As they scooted down the stairs, their arms gave out and they stopped to catch their breath. Eric had propped the folios on the steps with his foot when the librarian appears at the top of the stairs, beside herself with rage after finding Gooch hogtied in the rare book room.
Oh my god.
Eric drops the books and he and Warren make a run for it. And then Spencer, who was on lookout, I see Warren and Eric bust out of the back door. They were 20 steps ahead of the librarian. Chaz backs up the van and almost hits the woman as Eric comes around the door. Warren had to run up the side of the hill and frantically ran off. And Eric calls to him, so I see Warren go back. They jump in the van and peel out of the loop.
They got away?
So it's Chaz, Eric, and Warren in the car. Chaz is like, it's going to be suspicious, the 3 of us in the car together, because they know they're looking for 3 people. So you 2 get out. I'll go return the car to my mom, because it's almost 12:30. And
fair enough.
I'll get a new car and I'll come pick you back up. Insanity. Eric and Warren walk around, are nearly mugged in the neighborhood that Chaz drops them off in. They're running.
Honestly good.
They're like, almost like, should we find the police? And then they're like, we can't find the police. We just did this robbery. But at the last minute, Chaz makes good on his promise and picks them back up. At first, the guys are kind of like, that was a total failure because they had dropped the folios before they ran out. So they did
they
not
the
make it out.
They have the small books, though.
But, exactly, they actually have nearly $750,000 worth of books and manuscripts in their backpack, including a first edition of Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species, an illuminated manuscript from 1425, which is worth like $200,000, and, like, a ton of other very fancy things worth tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. So even though the heist is not great, they're like, we got to continue with the plan. We got these books. They decide to get the books appraised. They're going to go to Christie's in New York. This is Warren's idea because he's like, Christie's is the most famous place, so nobody would take stolen shit to Christie's, so they won't even be looking for stolen shit. I don't know that that's super sound reasoning.
Yeah, I feel like he thinks he's really doing something.
Yeah, and not so much. So Warren and Spencer go to Christie's. Warren is wearing a suit his parents bought him for his first job interviews, and Spencer is wearing his grandfather's blazer.
Great.
They go to Christie's. They say they're representatives for Walter Beckman, a very private individual from Boston, who had recently inherited several rare and valuable book manuscripts. Note, that is also the fake name they gave to BJ.
Are you kidding?
I know.
What idiots!
They bring in the books in suitcases wrapped in sheets and pillows. And
so obviously thieves.
And the Christie's employee, Melanie Halloran, checks out the books and she's like, okay, I will get back to you on this. And Spencer gives her his cell phone number to reach back out. At this point, the boys have fucked up in a couple ways. Number one, Spencer just gave the Christie's person his actual personal cell phone number.
Great.
So that can be traced. And again, number two, Warren not only used the same Walter Beckman name, he used the same email to set up the appointment with BJ and with Christie's. So, of course, the police are going to look at that email BJ got and look at the rest of those emails and see a Christie's connection. They know they're fucked, but they just kind of live their lives for a time, which, like, honestly, I can relate to in a way. Like, sometimes, like, the anxiety is so crushing that you're just kind of like,
fine,
guess I'll go about my day.
Sure.
Warren even re-enrolls in school after dropping out for heist full time. But, of course, the consequences pop up shortly. As Vanity Fair tells it, on the morning of February 11th, 2005, a SWAT unit broke down the front door of the yellow bungalow with a battering ram, blasting stun grenades throughout the building. A 20-man task force of the Lexington police and the FBI agents poured in over the wreckage. The ground floor quickly filled with shouting cops, screaming young women, and a few dazed men in boxer shorts. On the second floor landing, Chaz, in a high-end flannel pajamas, thinking they were being robbed, pulled out a derringer, only to drop the weapon at the last moment.
Oh, he could have gotten killed.
Oh, yeah. He almost got shot, says Eric, laughing. I was surprised he didn't.
What the fuck?
Cops entered the basement, a dank pit reeking of marijuana. That's
great.
From Vanity Fair, but I believe it. And found Warren sprawled out on his mattress. He was whisked into a squad car. In a duffel bag by his bed, an FBI agent discovered the stolen books, all undamaged, as well as the 5-page typed plan for the heist, an accounting ledger, wigs, instructions for opening a Swiss bank account, and stun guns, which had finally arrived for the robbery.
The Amazon package got there that morning.
It finally arrived. In a simultaneous raid, Spencer is arrested in his dorm room. And all four are brought to the Lexington police headquarters and individually interrogated by the FBI. They all immediately confess.
Of course.
Because it's like, what can we do? For a while, they are going to try to get Warren to take more time because it's pretty clear he was like the mastermind of this plan.
If you can call it that.
If you can call it that. They ultimately decide that like all four are equally culpable. And they all plead guilty, and they are all sentenced to identical 7-year terms.
That sounds about right.
So the Vanity Fair article that I've talked a lot about here, it ends with the four of them still in prison. Like, the author, John Falk, is interviewing them in jail.
Right.
But obviously, a lot of time has passed since then, so I was interested in what was going on. As the Vanity Fair story ends, they really still have, like, not a ton of remorse. And so the way that Vanity Fair tells it, aside from harming BJ, Spencer, Warren, and Eric maintain they have no regrets. In fact, they all tell me that as the planning picked up in the months before the heist, the three of them came to believe it was their best and perhaps last chance to create a viable life for themselves after college. Only by committing a felony could they ensure they would never end up living back in the sterile suburban world of the subdivisions. As far as they could see, there were only two ways out, getting away with the crime or getting arrested for it. Ugh.
Okay.
And as Eric says, we did the robbery as a way to escape. I think we all knew we wanted something different, and we had to break away from where we were living. If we got away with it, we'd be in Europe living this crazy life, thinking we were Ocean's 11 types. If not, we were going to get caught, and it was going to be a crazy story. And Warren says, now that we've diverted from that path, I feel liberated. We can never go back if we wanted to. I would rather not have been busted, but all I can say is it feels right in here, and before, in college, it just never did.
Ugh. He belonged in jail.
Yeah. He's like, at least in jail, it's cool.
It's crazy.
Spencer says, I remember talking to Eric and Warren one day, and I was like, so what? They're going to put us in jail. In a few years, we'll be released. We'll all be still young. And Warren says, we'll be stronger, better, wiser for going through this together, the three of us. They clearly don't really get along with Chaz, and he doesn't get interviewed for this story.
Chaz is like, what the fuck are you guys talking about?
Before, in college, growing up, we were being funneled into this mundane nickel and dime existence. Now we can't ever go back there. Even if we wanted to, they won't let us. That was the point all along. See, we have no choice now but to create something new, someplace else.
Fuck off.
Believe me, you haven't heard the last of us yet. Ugh.
That's so fucking stupid.
It's so fucking stupid. For, again, Warren specifically tried to do college for like 1 month before he quit.
It's giving, what's the Fyre Festival names guy?
Billy McFarland.
Billy McFarland. That guy.
Makes me so mad.
It's just ridiculous. I clearly just like absolutely no regard for anyone other than themselves. Clearly have lived lives of their mom did everything for them. They never had to worry about a thing. And then now they just are like, well, I can do whatever I want. I can take whatever the fuck I want. And if I get away with it, then I'm smart. Fuck off.
I know. And so they were released in 2012. Have they grown and changed? Not really. Chaz and Eric are both now, like, they've both written a book about it, and they're both, like, motivational speaker types. Warren is a filmmaker, and Spencer is an artist, and they've both taken inspiration from the heist. And Eric's book was even turned into a movie in 2018 called American Animals, which I actually kind of remembered the, like, trailers for and stuff when I heard the title.
I think I remember the title.
Yeah, so it stars Evan Peters and Barry, I can never pronounce his name, Keoghan? Barry Keoghan. And the four of them appear in the movie. Like, the movie features the four of them talking about the heist for real. And they went on this big press tour for it where they got to, again, like, spew more dumb stuff about, like, we were wanting, like, we were pushing back and rebelling against this wealthy suburban lifestyle.
No, no.
Like, it was an escape. It was a way out. Like, they got to do a whole press tour in 2018 when they did, where they said that again.
Ew.
That's the most, like, horrifying part of this to me, is just, like, fuck these guys. Come on.
They suck so bad.
They suck so bad. The only hero in this story, Betty Jean Gooch.
That's right.
Again, like, so I said, she wasn't originally interviewed for the Vanity Fair article. She started getting interviews when American Animals came out because she also appears, like, for a short amount of time in that movie. And so there are a couple of her quotes from her Associated Press interview that are fire, so I wanted to end on her instead of the fuckers.
Absolutely.
So here's some words from sweet Betty Jean Gooch. Forgiveness is a work in progress. I have good days and bad days. The bottom line is, I don't bear them any ill will. I really don't anymore. The bottom line is, how can you go on with your life if you wake up every morning with this huge grudge filled with hate and all this? And then she says, they were wanting a transformative experience, but they refused to work for it. They wanted to get it the easy way. And what came across was a very human desire to leave a mark on the world. But these young men, they went about it all the wrong way. They came from good families. They wanted excitement. They wanted to be known for something big. Spencer makes this remark that artists need to suffer. It's a very human desire to want to be considered unique. It's difficult to feel sympathy, but I'm working on it.
That's so true. That, like, they just want to be the fucking main character.
Exactly.
Ew.
And again, like, they experienced 1 month of college, and they were like, we need to steal and get away from this suburban life.
Right? Yeah, well, they have lived in a bubble of, I want, I get, immediately. And there's plenty of people who live in that bubble and recognize it and are, you know, like, yeah, that's a thing. But I think that they would, like, the fact that they're talking about themselves as, like, rebelling against, like, they see themselves as the victims.
Yeah.
Even though that's nonsense. Fuck these guys.
I know, they suck. Unfortunately, so I've never seen American Animals. Unfortunately, I heard it was pretty good.
Maybe we should watch it.
Maybe we'll watch it. Maybe we will, and we'll give you guys a review. But yeah, it just, like, this story, like, truly made me so mad that I was just like, you guys are so privileged that you were like, I think a jail sentence would actually be better than just the kind of life my parents had living as in suburbia.
The kind of life my parents probably sacrificed and worked extremely hard for, you know.
Yeah. It's just so...
To send them to college, which they were able to go to.
Exactly. So it just makes me so mad. And that's the story of the Transylvania University book heist.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I was imagining a gothic sort of Victorian, like, old school uniforms, maybe, you know.
I want to suck your books. Is that not what you were expecting?
A little.
Is that not what you wanted?
A little.
Are you not entertained?
A little bit. Maybe like a horror novel heist?
Yes. They're stealing like a first edition of Dracula.
Sure. I don't know. Not, but this is not what I thought it would
not
be.
Not like that. It do not be like that.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for that.
You're
that
welcome.
That was exquisite. An exquisite tale of just garbage humans.
Yes.
How? Ugh.
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 Yuck.
Yuck.
But you know what's not yucky? Our horror honeys liking and reviewing us. And subscribing.
Yes, Sam.
I'm
Sam.
I'm trying to remember to put it in now.
You're doing really good.
Thank you.
I love it.
Oh my God.
I'm over here like lounging. I'm like, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do any work.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
next week you'll be doing some work because it's your week.
And I'll pimp us then.
Ooh, exciting.
I'm excited for next week.
So until Allie pimps us.
Nope.
No.
No. So.
So until next week. Bye-bye, horror honeys.
We'll see you next Tuesday.
I'm Horrified is a Hemlock Creatives production, recorded and produced by us, Sam Bierstow and Allie Gavin, in Boston, Massachusetts. Our art is by Leah Brilliard and Allie Gavin. You can find us on Twitter at I'm Horrified Pod and at I'mHorrifiedPodcast.com. And you can tell us what horrifies you at imhorrifiedpodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us directly on Patreon, you can get our podcast early and ad-free, as well as bonus episodes of our members-only minicasts, I'm Thrilled! Check us out at patreon.com/imhorrified. And if you liked hanging out with us, tell your friends, share us on your socials, and leave us a review wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for stopping by, Horror Honeys.